Today is Wednesday, July 12th, the year 2000. We're at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. I'm Jeff Charnley, along with Dr. Fred Honhart, interviewing Dr. John DiBiagio for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution to be commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, we're tape recording this oral history today. Dr. DiBiagio, do you give us permission to record this interview?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'd like to start first with a little bit about your educational and professional background prior to coming to Michigan State.
Well, I grew up in the city of Detroit, went to elementary and secondary school in the public school system in that city. I graduated from Denby High School in Detroit, which is on the east side. Then spent my first 2 years in college at Wayne University working while I was in school. My parents are both immigrants and were factory workers in the city, so despite the fact that I have an older sister, I was the first to attend college in the family. After spending 2 years there, and I decided to transfer because I wanted to have an experience away from home, and ended up going to Eastern Michigan, in part because when I just talked with the people there, they offered me an opportunity to work while I was there, which I had to do in order to pay for my education. Graduated from there, wondering what I might do with my life, having majors in chemistry and English. The University of Michigan offered me a fellowship to work on a PhD in English, but my father felt that was not a particularly impressive calling to be a college professor. So how can you make a living as a college professor? And so he said, you really need a profession. Took an examination and they suggested I would be suited for law. But my father didn't feel that law was a terribly appropriate profession either. And I got it at a home of a dear friend of mine whose family was a bit more affluent. I had a sister that was a PhD, a brother that was a physician, a brother was a dentist. And we discussed what I might do with my career. And they convinced me that evening that I should go to dental school, predicated on the fact that the physician was working very hard. There were before partnerships, before there were groups, and he was an obstetrician. And he said, gee, it's taking an enormous amount of my effort. And my brother, who's a dentist, is doing as well as I am financially and has a lot more time to explore other interests, and you have many interests. So I ended up going to dental school at the University of Detroit. I went the next day virtually with my application to the dental school. I hadn't really taken an examination or anything, and I was admitted because I'd been a good student. And I spent 4 years in dental school, always wondering what in the world I was doing there. Really wasn't, you know, suited to me, but I'm a compulsive person, so I did well academically, graduated, went into practice initially in Detroit for a brief period of time, and then into Baltimore, Michigan, where I had a very, very successful practice, was president of the school board, town discussed my running for mayor, I served on a number of other boards, and I wondered why in the world I was doing all that. And at the same time, I was teaching a couple of days down at the University of Detroit. I'd drive down to their dental school to teach. And I finally decided after a few years of that that perhaps this wasn't the ideal thing for me to be doing. So I determined that I would return to school and went to the University of Michigan and earned a graduate degree in the Center for Higher Education there, and in a degree which is fundamentally for university administrators. My thought then was that I would be a dean, something that I wouldn't have dreamed of as a young person, but gee, that would be quite an accomplishment to become a dean of a dental school. I was, immediately after I was finished my degree at Michigan, I was offered an assistant deanship at the University of Kentucky. Spent 3 years there, and then I was offered 5 dental deanships. There are only 50 odd dental schools in the country. And I chose to go to the Medical College of Virginia. They had some serious problems, which I helped to address. And after 6 years there, this was now 1976, I was approached by 3 different medical centers to consider assuming the responsibility of oversight for those medical centers as a vice president for health affairs for the universities that approached me. It was surprising for a dentist, but Not altogether so, because I had a lot of administrative experience and they were looking for that. So I went to the University of Connecticut in 1976 to become Vice President for Health Affairs and Executive Director of the Medical Center. There were some very serious problems there. In fact, of the three that I was interviewed by, and I think I could have had any of them, this had the most difficulty. And that's why I accepted it. It also had the lowest salary. But I felt that if I could straighten this out, then I would have a career before me in this area of management of medical centers, not thinking beyond that at all. We'd straightened out the problems in 3 years. And at the same time, concurrently, the president of the university decided to resign. And now the faculty approached me and said, would you be a candidate for the presidency of the university? I was now in my mid-40s and had never thought of being a university president. But lo and behold, the process went forward. I was a unanimous choice and assumed the presidency of the University of Connecticut, something that I had never really contemplated.
What year was that?
That was in 1979. During my tenure there, especially during the last couple of years, several universities approached me, suggesting that I might want to consider moving to a more complex, a larger institution. I wasn't particularly interested because I was very happy at Connecticut. They treated me very well. I had gone through one search at Florida, which was kind of peculiar, and I thought, well, perhaps I shouldn't even, be thinking about this. But then I was contacted by Michigan State, and I was intrigued, not only because I had some admiration for what John Hanna had done at Michigan State, and with the land-grant concept in general, but additionally, it was an opportunity to return home. I have an elderly mother still in Michigan, now 91, in assisted living, and my sister and her family were there. And so it was a chance to come home and to lead a really, truly major university and perhaps to, spend a career there, which was sort of my objective. This would have been, as you know, now 1985, so I was 52 years of age, about to turn 53 when I went there, and could have contemplated staying there through retirement. And I came to know John very, very well. I'd known him from afar, and we became rather close, as a matter of fact, to the point where when John passed away, I was asked by the family to eulogize him, and that was very high praise indeed. But that's how I got to where I am, and it's a peculiar route, I know, not the traditional route for an academic, but one which has been comfortable for me. And then, when I left Michigan State again, I had several opportunities and opted to come here to Tufts.
Your relationship with Dr. Blanche Martin. I talked with him, and he talked a little bit about having you as a professor. What do you remember about him?
Well, it's very peculiar because, it didn't even occur to me that Blanche was on the Board of Trustees. I had known him as a student and knew him well enough, and he was a very good student, by the way. Blanche was, not an athlete that wasn't academically competitive, because he was a very bright young man. But he decided he wanted to, and I went through a tragedy with him when he was a student. He lost his first wife, came home and found her dead. She had a heart problem and she died while he was a student. And, I became close to him during that period. But then when he decided he wanted to enter practice, he thought he would come back to East Lansing to practice. And he talked to me about it, but he was concerned that, how would they accept an African American practicing in what was, virtually a majority community. And I said, gee, Blanche, I haven't a clue, but why don't we go up, you and I, and visit some people, particularly Duffy Doherty, and, just get a sense and look for some space and do some things and talk to some people and see if this was even a possibility. So we went up to see Duffy. I hadn't met Duffy before. It was a delightful meeting, as you might guess. And Blanche said, you know, I told Duffy what Blanche was contemplating, and we chatted about it, and he said, turn to Blanche. He said, now, Blanche, you go over there and you open up an office on Grand River, and you'll have every bit of trauma that comes through this football team, in this athletic department, and that'll keep you busy all by itself. And that's how Blanche Martin decided to settle there. Interestingly, then when I went back to encounter him, it was a surprise to me. I hadn't realized what had happened to him in his career. It had been many years since I'd seen him, but it was kind of a delight, you know, to find that he was on the board of trustees and he prospered in the Lansing area.
Did he make any contacts with you when you were at Connecticut in terms of?
I think in the process when they were, you know, we were going through the search. Now he wasn't on the board any longer, I think, by that time. But he called me a few times to urge me to consider it. Apparently, he had some conflicts with some of the people there, and he was hoping that I would help to resolve those. At least that's the sense that I got. But it wasn't anything like that being critical or anything, but I got the sense that he was disturbed about some things that had happened, and he was just anxious about the possibility that I might come, you know. And then afterwards, when I arrived there, we spent some time together, and he told me about some of his concerns.
What do you remember about the search process coming back?
Yeah, it was interesting because, I was invited to be interviewed in Cleveland. They broke the board up into two groups, four and four, so that they wouldn't violate the Freedom of Information Act and still could maintain privacy, because I told them that there was no way as a sitting president that I could allow myself to be publicly exposed in the process, because it would be very difficult, you know, to come back then if I weren't their choice or if I weren't interested. But I went to Cleveland, was interviewed, and they thereafter called and said, gee, you know, we really want to have you come. We'd like to talk to you again. And four trustees flew in here to Boston and met with me and discussed the possibility of my coming at that time. And thereafter, we made the decision to do so.
You mentioned that when you went to Connecticut or you're at Kentucky, there were some problems at those universities. What did you see when you first came to Michigan State? What do you remember as some of the most difficult problems you faced?
Well, some of the problems still exist, of course, and the greatest problem that Michigan State faces is that, you know, it doesn't receive the kind of support financially from the state that it merits. And it's always seems to be overwhelmed by the University of Michigan, and in part by Wayne, because of the representation that they had in the legislature, at least at that time. You will recall it was a Democratic legislature and a Democratic governor, and they had entree through some very powerful people then in the legislature who had considerable control over higher education funding. And I recognized immediately that the university was doing many good things, but doing them without adequate resources, and it didn't have any endowment to speak of either. And when I first arrived, the only vehicle for enhancing our financial circumstance was to increase tuition. And our tuition was modest at best compared to, what someone pays at a private institution such as this one. And so we recommended, the board recommended an increment in tuition. Well, Governor Blanchard had spoken out publicly against any increases in tuition, and had made a big issue of it publicly. And so I was had not either money coming from the state at adequate levels, no endowment to speak of, and no potential for generating it through student tuition. I went to visit with the governor, and I said, Governor Blanchard, is it possible for me to increase fees? Well, you know, it's kind of specious, but he said, yeah, that's okay. I just don't want you to increase tuition. So we increased the fees substantially, and the next thing I knew, I was called on the carpet by Speaker of the House and the legislature and a member of the legislature from the Detroit area, and read the Riot Act to for about an hour. And I said, well, gee, you know, you're both Democrats. And I went to the governor, and he has nothing to do with this. This is our decision, you know. It was an amazing experience for me. Disappointing because of the behavior and the language that was used. I was really taken aback. But, you know, we were warned that if we did this again, you know, they would reduce further the support from the state. But it was a struggle constantly while I was there to try to achieve equity. Because one of the things that disturbed me about Michigan State was the paranoia that existed, the feeling that somehow or other they were always inferior to the University of Michigan. You know, I would say publicly, constantly, the University of Michigan's a great graduate elitist institution in the best sense of the word. We are a great land-grant university, and that's what we should be, the best of all the land-grants. And the state of Michigan is indeed fortunate to have a great elitist institution and a great land-grant institution. And, you know, I've used lots of examples, like the fact that before Michigan State was created, a student couldn't get admitted into the University of Michigan unless they had attended a private high school. And we opened up education to everyone, and pointed out how much we contributed to the economy, and used those kinds of approaches to make people feel better about who they were and the contributions that they were making, which I fundamentally, firmly believe they were. And I think it impacted somewhat, but unfortunately the dichotomy was so great to do something about it was very difficult, because incremental increases were never adequate. In fact, the dichotomy became greater, because if you got a percentage increase, an institution or anyone with more resources to begin with, the increment becomes larger in true dollars, and that's what we were facing continuously, and it was very frustrating. The other thing was that we didn't seem able to influence the process in terms of trustees and the selection of trustees. John Hanna told me on several occasions that the biggest mistake he had made was as part of the Constitutional Convention agreeing to the election of trustees as a trade-off for institutions getting greater autonomy. That is University of Michigan, Michigan State, and Wayne. The reality is that the autonomy didn't truly exist, because, as I said, if the concept was that you would manage your own affairs. But if you did something that the legislature or the governor disagreed with, they'd penalize you the following year by decreasing your budget or by not providing funds for a facility you wanted to build or whatever. There was always that threat, so you really weren't autonomous. And yet you were still straddled with the idea of trustees being elected in statewide election in political parties. We often tried to influence the nominations, but we're not always effective at that. I recall one instance where a young woman was a nominee and came to visit with us, because we invited all the nominees, both parties, out to the campus to try to orient them to what was happening at the university. And I said, what brought you to this? I mean, why did you decide that you wanted to run for Well, she said, I was just called the night before the convention and asked if I would be a candidate. And she said, I went to the University of Michigan. I don't know anything about Michigan State. I don't really know how I got here. And I was really taken aback, because here I have a governor who's a Michigan State graduate, and I have a candidate who has no awareness of the university, and I thought a perfectly bright person, it might have made a good trustee, but not exactly the kind of person you would, you know, assume would be. She lost in the election. But the reality is that I wasn't interested in which party a trustee came from. I was interested in people who had some knowledge of higher education and were committed to the purposes of Michigan State. Unfortunately, that happened far too often. The nominations were seen as patronage. The candidates were often selected for reasons other than their interest in serving in these roles. In fact, some of them had to go through a litmus test, which had nothing to do with higher education, such as their stand on the pro-choice, you know, pro-life issue. Extraordinary. But we were never able to quite influence it, despite the fact that all during my time there and thereafter, interestingly, for the first time in history, there was a governor who was a Michigan State graduate. I was able to Governor Engler's credit, when there was, you know, under the system, if there's an open up position because somebody resigns or there's a death, then on an interim basis, an appointment could be made by the governor. And Governor Engler called me to ask me about appointees, and that's how Russ Mauby, for instance, got on the board. But then he didn't want to run, he didn't want to be in the political contest, so after the 6 years that he served, he decided, you know, he would step off. But, you know, I found the state to be much more politicized than when I had left. You know, when I left Michigan back there in 1967, the legislature was in great part from rural background, was in great part conservative, but even more dedicated to education. Education was a very, very high priority with them. And the board at Michigan State was virtually the Board of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And was very supportive of everything that Michigan State was doing, you know, because of that. But when I came back, the shift had changed, and you know, it was dramatic. Things had altered dramatically in terms of the backgrounds of the members of the legislature and their view of issues that were of consequence, at least to those of us at Michigan State.
So you saw a marked contrast between Governor Engler and Governor Blanchard in terms of their approach to the university, or wasn't that a...
Well, you know, I
complete change.
it was somewhat different. I think Jamie depended upon some people that were close to him, and in my view, on occasion, gave him bad counsel. I think John Engler was more his own person, made his own decisions.
How would you characterize your relationship with them and also their support of the university?
Well, my relationship with them was very good. I mean, very friendly, very open. You know, we had a bit of a difference, Governor Blanchard and I, over athletics and the role of athletics, but I've seen him since, and it's always been very pleasant. John Engler was in our house many times, both of them were, and I just saw Michelle a while back at something I was at Michigan, and we chatted warmly, you know. I think I had no problems with them or with most people in the legislature, with a few exceptions, but the vast majority were supportive. I think in some instances there was a bit more intrusion than, maybe because Michigan State has the misfortune of being in the state capitol. And you know that along with everything else that's read daily down there, they read the state news, you know. And sometimes it isn't always very kind to public officials.
Or accurate.
Or accurate, but you know, they read it, you know, like it's absolute fact, you know, and we all know better than that.
Michigan paper might not be distributed down there.
Well, I mean, if it is distributed a while after it's come out and someone's had a chance to explain with ours, it was there the same day, you know.
Would you talk a little bit about the capital campaign? I mean, obviously you did something important about the funding equity through...
Yeah, they hadn't had a capital campaign, and when I arrived there, I said, you know, we just have to generate some private support. I mean, we just obviously are not going to get the kinds of money we need from the state very quickly. And Michigan State had never had a substantial capital campaign. So we put one together, and we began by hitting some major sources to set the tone. And we started with Chrysler, because we knew if we got a gift from Chrysler, then the gift from Ford would be a bit larger, and the gift from General Motors would have to be larger than that. And we were successful. We used a different strategy than normally is used. I mean, I would go to visit, and I came to know Iacocca at the time, and Don Peterson very well, and I was before Jack, head of General Motors at the time.
Roger Smith.
Yeah, Roger Smith. Okay, and I visited each of them, and I began by pointing out how many of our graduates that they employed, which were substantial in number, and then asked them, how are we doing? What's your perception? And listened to their views, you know, about what they thought of our graduates, and what we might be doing differently. For instance, Iacocca said, "Well, you're sending us wonderful engineers, but they can't write reports." And if they can't articulate their knowledge, they're of little value to us. So I went back to engineering, and I said, this is what Lee Iacocca tells me. And they instituted in 25% of their classes a writing component, which I thought was a good response. I explained that to Lee, and he was pleased to hear that. But he was really interested in K-12 education, and we talked about that at great length. And so then I said, well, let us come up with some ideas and talk to your vice president for corporate giving, you know, and have our people talk to that person, and maybe they can put some. Well, you know, by the time we then gave him a proposal, it was a fait accompli. And they gave us whatever it was in those days, $2 million. So Ford gave us $3 million. General Motors gave us $5 million. And then, you know, we were starting to get some substantial gifts, and people began to notice us. And then we were able to, after long negotiation, get the Broad gift, which was substantial, Eli Broad's gift, and that set a new standard. And suddenly people began to recognize that, you know, maybe we were an institution worth investing in. And that's how it all came about. And when I said to them, I want to raise, they said, well, maybe we can raise $100 million. And I said, well, what about $160 million? And we ended up raising $250 million. And it all, you know, the most important thing about it, I kept saying, was not the amount we raised, but establishing a pattern of giving. And once we had done that and gotten the people in place that had the capability, the structure, then we could continue to raise money forever. So we had to succeed at the first campaign. In fact, we had to do very well at it. But more importantly, we had to develop the organizational structure that led to fundraising in the future. That was my real interest. And it succeeded.
And how did you feel about that in that first result?
Well, I thought it was remarkable, considering we were a public university and had never done this before. You know, it's an interesting thing. When I was at Connecticut, we had their first capital campaign. And we had the same kind of problems getting the legislature to support us, because there were all these great private, Yale was in Connecticut, all these great private institutions. They said, why do we need to put all this money into the University of Connecticut? When I got the corporate community to start to contribute, that piqued the interest of the legislature. And they began to look at us differently. It was a strange thing. I mean, we were the same institution, but they said, gee, if the corporate community, which is so important to this state, is interested in the university, we should be as well. And it changed their whole attitude. And I think it worked. I think it worked at Michigan State too. Parenthetically, you know, during the same time we were working very hard on the image of the university, and I was out everywhere. I mean, I think I spoke to every group in the state. I mean, every service club and every alumni group, and God knows, someone once asked me how small a group I would speak to, and I said two, and I could be one of them, you know. And you know, it's interesting because I have talked to former regents at the University of Michigan since, and they told me that was really beginning to upset them, that Michigan State was gaining so much recognition, and they were really concerned about that. And they kept saying to their people, look what they're doing over at Michigan State, you know. And you know, all I was doing was taking what we had. I mean, we had all these, you know, cooperative extension offices and all these opportunities to get into communities. I was just using it to its nth degree.